This is Sciographies, an introduction to people who make Canadian science happen.
I'm David Barkley, co-host and an assistant professor in the Department of Oceanography.
I'm Shauna Bullman, co-host, neuroscience student, and science communication intern.
I'm Nicole Comeau, and we're all from Dalhousie University's Faculty of Science. In this episode, we speak with Dr. Mita Dusog, an assistant professor of chemistry here at Dalhousie, and one of the winners of Canada's top 150 Women in STEM awards last year in 2017. Mita's work falls into the field of materials science. She uses what she calls shake-and-bake chemistry to discover new ways to better harvest sunlight for stronger solar energy applications in the future. Growing up in India, Mita recognized the economic disparity in the country and felt she really needed to contribute to social issues, like access to electricity, through science. By designing new materials for renewable energy sources that are cost-effective and scalable, she's a leader in the new generation of scientists working diligently for a more equitable and clean energy future. She tells us about her life before becoming an academic researcher, and then she elaborates on her work and the challenges scientists are up against in the effort to move society away from burning more fossil fuels for energy.
So I do know that you did your BSc in Saskatchewan.
Yes.
And so did you grow up there?
I was born in Saskatoon.
Okay.
But my parents are from India.
Mm-hmm.
So they decided to move back to India. So I grew up in India, and then I came back because India doesn't have a dual citizenship program. So I decided to come back for my undergrad. So I came back to Saskatchewan.
Okay. So what was the timing and all that? You were born in Saskatoon.
Yes.
And right away, they went back to India?
Within a year, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I was a baby.
What made you want to come back to Saskatoon? What was that decision-making process like?
So there was a couple reasons why I wanted to come back. So if I wanted to continue university in India, I had to pay international tuition because I never, you know, got Indian citizenship.
You were still Canadian, yes. Even though you spent 17 and a half years or whatever, 17 and...
Yeah, yeah, I spent 16 years because I came back to Canada when I was 16.
Okay.
And also program I was interested in studying or taking in university, it felt like it might be better here.
So you were quite serious from the get-go. You knew what you wanted to study.
Sort of. I thought I knew, but things changed along the way. So to just give you a background, so my dad is actually a professor and a scientist as well. So he was doing his PhD in agriculture in Saskatchewan.
Makes perfect sense now. It all makes sense to me.
And then they moved back to India. And when I was a little girl, I used to sort of visit my dad's lab. And I didn't really know much about science per se, but I liked the idea of like having a lab. You know, I liked visiting his lab. I thought titrations were really cool for some reason. That fascinated me. But as I sort of...
That's because the stuff falls out, right? It's like yeah. Liquid, you pour another liquid in, and then you get a solid that falls out. That is like magic, basically.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, and also I liked the indicators. So you could like mix two colorless liquids, and then suddenly you would have color. And I was like, how does that happen? It's magic. So that was really
We should clarify that's not magic. Any listeners are confused.
No, it's pH dependent. So. as I grew older, you know, I stopped visiting my dad's lab and I was sort of a very typical child and I went through a phase where I wanted to be a rock star. I think I really sort of fell in love with science after the summer of grade 8. So my dad got this project that was funded by the World Bank. India has problems with fresh water because there is not a lot of fresh water resources there. And with climate change and things like that, the amount of fresh water is decreasing, especially during summertime when the rivers and lakes dry up. And they have two cycles of agriculture. And it requires a lot of irrigation. So it's not like Canada. You actually need to water the plants in India. So that takes up a lot of fresh water. Mm-hmm. And because we were running out of fresh water, that affected farmers a lot. And because my dad's an agriculture scientist, he was sort of got involved in this water conservation project. And it was a very multifaceted project. But part of it involved visiting these coastal places. I was in grade 8. I thought it was a very good chance to tag along with my dad and visit all these beaches.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's the first time I actually sort of learned how science is actually applicable every day and actually makes a difference in society. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was sort of something different from what you learn in textbook because, you know, when you take science in school, it's like, okay, it's a bunch of laws. That was the first time I realized that it's more of a dynamic thing. There's research that happens and is happening and how, you know, we're trying to solve social issues, economic issues, societal issues using science.
Okay.
So that's really when I kind of, I guess, fell in love with science.
Yeah. But that was a pivotal moment for
yes.
you. And grade 8, that's got to be, what, 13? The travel was probably very cool. But then seeing, yes. was he interacting with people or was he just going out into the field and looking at plants? What did that entail?
It was really cool. So he interacted with scientists mm-hmm. and trying to learn how they were trying to do this genetic engineering and trying to understand the genetic makeup of all these plants. But they were also interacting with farmers mm-hmm. and families that lived in these villages because the big part of this project was also to sort of educate people, try to tell them, you know, what climate change is, why fresh water is important. It was kind of cool to see that aspect, like yeah. how educating people was important. Mm-hmm. And it's not just about being in your lab and doing research,
yeah.
you know, it's sort of going and actually interacting mm-hmm. with people and explaining to them why this matters and how it affects, you know, their economy.
Your father came to Saskatoon to do a PhD?
Yes.
And then moved back. And so how did they talk about Saskatoon when you were growing up? Was it mythical or was it, you know, a blip?
There was a lot of photos. So I did, you know, see a lot of the photos and mm-hmm. I was very fascinated with snow. There was a lot of dirt photos because that's what my dad did. He was a soil scientist.
Yeah.
So I've seen a lot of layers of soil in Saskatchewan. I thought that's how it is. It's just soil.
Not too far off the truth, I suppose. It wasn't you weren't fantasizing about it growing up, but then you wanted to do agriculture yourself, I'm guessing.
Yeah, so I was interested in, I guess, biotechnology mm-hmm. Because that's something I'd seen, and that's really what got me interested in science. So that's what I wanted to do in my university.
Okay, and obviously another detail here, 16. Did you go to university at 16?
I started my university at 16.
The Doogie Howser. You're a child genius.
No, I turned 17 right away. So I'm only a year okay. younger than most of my cohort. So.
And was it a huge culture shock to come from India?
It was a little bit overwhelming. But the university started within a week after I got. So there was not a lot of time, I guess, mm-hmm. to sort of think about a lot of things. You know, you started university, you had your 5 classes. I got busy quite quickly, so it kept me occupied.
You had this like kind of research interest, but did that really inform what classes you took, or did the classes sort of spin you off into a tangent of studying different things?
So my first year, I just took most first year classes. And I was trying to look for a job for summer. And one of the graduate students told me that you could do summer research in labs and, you know, get paid to mm-hmm. do so. So I thought, okay, I'll look into that. So I applied to a couple different places. And this graduate student was in the chemistry department. So I applied within the chemistry department, even though I was in the biotechnology program. I applied to 2 professors. One was sort of doing plant biology, and the other person was doing analytical chemistry. And because of like titrations, I thought maybe I could do that. The analytical prof said he didn't really have any positions for me that summer, but there was a new prof that had just joined the department, and maybe it's worth a shot for me to contact that person. And I was like, sure. So I contacted this professor, his name's Rob Scott, and he was like, sure, you know, come on, we'll have a chat. And then he told me that he works in the field of nanotechnology. I had no clue what that meant. And he was like, yes, I'm looking for, you know, people to help me set up my lab and get me started here. So he offered me a summer research position. I mm-hmm. was a first-year student. So this doesn't happen very
17.
Yes.
So you're a 17-year-old first-year student with a summer job. So, yeah, okay. I get the picture here. Yeah.
But I was terrified to start this job because I was not a chemistry major. I didn't know anything about what this person was doing. But I was like, well, you know, worst case scenario, I'll get fired. So I started. But he was one of the greatest mentor I've had mm-hmm. throughout my career.
You finish up, and are you homesick? You thinking, I should go back to India, or you're loving Canada? You think, I'll go to graduate school here? What's that decision-making process look like?
I mean, I did miss my family, but I did love living in Canada. So, yes, I loved research, so I wanted to continue doing it. And the obvious path was to sort of go into graduate school. I decided to move to Edmonton, the neighboring province, for my graduate school. Mm-hmm. So I had worked with a lot of metal nanoparticles during my undergrad. So, and I decided to change it a little bit. So I went from working with metals to sort of semiconductor, this quantum dots,
okay.
as people call it, so right. for my PhD. Quantum dot is a semiconductor nanoparticle. So basically something like a silicon wafer, right? So you can mm-hmm. see the wafer. So if I took that wafer and made smaller and smaller and smaller pieces of that, and made it on the order of 5 nanometers, then we have something called a quantum dot. And these materials have very unique optical and electronic properties.
Yeah, very hot topic
yes.
at the time. And so did you go, do you do a master's or do you go right into a PhD?
I went right into my PhD.
Right, okay, makes sense. Starting at 17, you get 16, sorry. Starting at 16, makes sense, you go right into the PhD. And that was what, how many years did that take you?
So it took me 4.5 years.
Oh
to
my
finish
God.
My PhD.
This is unbelievable. So let me just do the math here. You're 25, you're 24 when you got your PhD. I mean, wow. Yeah. And what were your impressions of Halifax?
I liked it. I liked that there is history, I guess, in mm-hmm. Maritimes. That you don't usually see in the prairies, right?
Yeah.
So I like that aspect of the Maritimes. I like the water.
Yes.
So I really like the
Again,
ocean.
Again, back
so.
To the titration. You just love water. What's in it? I do want to ask, now that you're a new prof, you're a new prof, let's say, are you taking on students? Are you taking on, you know, precocious 16-year-old students at all? Have you found any that are to help you get set up?
I actually have 2 first-year students in my lab this
good,
summer.
Good.
But I also have some graduate students and senior undergrad students. But yes, I do want to pay it forward.
Yes.
I do want to get, you know, first-year students started or get them interested in research right mm-hmm. away, because that's very important, at least to me. It was important to me. And I think it will make a big difference to get that hands-on experience and actually see what research looks like
right.
in the lab, as opposed to these pre-designed labs that students usually do.
Now that we've heard a little bit about Mita's life story with David, let's shift over to Shauna for more science.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about your research. So here at Dow, what are you, what does your research focus on?
So the big umbrella that we work under is renewable energy.
Uh-huh.
So what we are trying to do is address these storage issues. So obviously, we want cleaner sources of energy, and solar is one of the more obvious answers and choices right now, given that it's clean, it's abundant, it's free, and it's going to be around for a while.
Yeah, yeah. What, 32 degrees today? I think we've got some sun.
But the challenge with solar is that we have access to its energy as long as the sun is out. Mm-hmm. Once the sun sets, we lose that source of energy. So we need some way to actually store the energy from sun, mm-hmm. so we can use it at nighttime or on cloudy days or when sun is not around.
Of course.
So we don't have a good way of doing that right now. We use batteries. And there's a lot of great battery research that's being done. But the problem is the energy density. So we can't store a lot of it and for a very long time. So what we try to do is we have taken inspiration from nature. So what plants do during photosynthesis process is that they take sunlight and convert carbon dioxide and water molecules into sugar. Mm-hmm. And they store the energy from sun in the chemical bonds of the sugar molecules. Sure. So at nighttime, they burn the sugar to provide them energy. So we try to do the same thing in our lab. So we store the energy that we get from the sun in chemical bonds. So we make simple molecules, and we store the energy in the chemical bonds of these molecules. And once the sun is not around, we can burn these fuels to give us electricity or source of energy.
So I guess the equation we all learn of photosynthesis in grade 6 really is relevant. So, okay, interesting. And so where did your interest in renewable energy or clean energy come from?
My day starts with making a pot of coffee. Mm-hmm. So from that very moment, you know, it has to be plugged into the wall and you need energy to sort of power that.
Yes.
And everything that we do in our life, we need energy to do it.
Yeah.
Having access to energy means we have better life. Mm-hmm. We have access to healthcare. We can grow food. We can travel. So it's really key to doing all these things.
Absolutely.
So if you want to address social issues, we really need, you know, access to energy to be able to do everything. And we need to do it in a clean way, mm-hmm. right? We can't keep burning fossil fuels and increasing our carbon footprint. So our energy demand is increasing, our population is increasing, but we also need to cut down on our carbon footprint. So how do we do this simultaneously? So
yeah, you've got two sort of big directions to pull and exactly. have to find a bit of a balance there. I think that when I notice the most how much we use energy is when we have a power outage, which happens a lot in Halifax. We had one recently and it had sort of been all day, and by 8 p.m. all of my roommates kind of looked around and went, well, I guess we should just go to bed. It's wild how much we depend on energy, but it's so much a part of our lives that we really don't notice it until it's not there.
Exactly.
What does the area of research in clean energy, yours specifically or more broad, look like right now? Are there large holes? Is our main concern storage? Do we know how to do it, but we can't keep it?
In the broad field, as far as storage is concerned, there's a lot of great research that's being done on the batteries end. You mm-hmm. know, people are trying to improve the batteries and the energy density there. There is also my field where we are trying to make fuels to store the solar energy. Depending on what fuel you're trying to make, there's different challenges. So if you want to make hydrogen from water, So to do that right now, the materials that are good at doing this tend to be precious metals like platinum mm-hmm. and ruthenium and iridium.
So it's expensive.
It's expensive.
Okay.
So one of the big things that we do in my research lab is trying to replace these precious metals with some of the cheaper, more earth-abundant, non-toxic materials and see if they can perform as well as these precious metals. Usually they don't, but We tried to engineer, so we tried to play with the size of these materials, so try to make nanoparticles, so sometimes having higher sort of surface area helps with the activity. We try to dope them with certain things, see if we can improve properties that way. So we really try to engineer these earth-abundant materials and get them to be as efficient as these precious metals.
Okay, wow, we've got a doping scandal. And so how realistic do you think sort of a clean energy world is? Are we coming up on it soon? Is it, you know, maybe not in our lifetime?
Well, we want to, you know, implement clean energy technologies and do good in society. I think at the end of the day, it comes down to cost.
Mm-hmm.
So I think right now, we might have solutions. There are answers out there, but they're just not cost effective.
Okay.
And if they're cost effective, then they might have safety concern
mm-hmm.
or lifetime concerns. So it's not so much that the technology isn't there, but it just doesn't satisfy all the demands of cost, of stability, of lifetime that we're looking at. So it might have two or three of the things that we're looking at.
Right.
So it might just be solving that one piece.
Yeah.
I think we are coming up on it soon because of the Paris Agreement.
Okay.
So solar is becoming very popular.
Mm-hmm.
We set a lot of records in the last couple of years. So solar energy is quite cheap now.
Yeah.
There is places that have gone completely 100% solar in
wow.
Caribbean.
Oh, wow.
And there is European countries that are increasingly producing their energy using renewable resources such as solar panels, wind, tidal. So we're making great progress. So I think the challenge is, again, storing it and integrating it into sort of the grid scale
mm-hmm.
And stabilizing all this is where the challenge is. And I think we will address those in our lifetime.
Cool. And how does our geography sort of impact the different energy that we can use? Being north, we have times where we don't have as much solar. And so is that sort of our main challenge?
I think, yes, we do have to take into consideration sort of our geography as well. Like, so Canada has done very well harvesting hydro.
Okay.
Because we have a lot of hydro resources.
We have a lot of water up here.
So we do have to take that into consideration when we are looking at different renewable options that are available to us. We can't discard anything.
Sure.
I think research and development has to be done in all aspects. So I think that one of the challenges people usually want sort of one answer,
mm-hmm.
being like, oh, this is going to solve everything. And I don't think that's always the case.
Mm-hmm.
So depending on where people live, there might be different options that
mm-hmm.
are more suitable. So in places like prairies, solar, you know, there's a lot of sunshine there. So solar would be a good option there.
A lot of wind, too. And so it's more about using what you have in particular areas, not sort of trying to make it fit a one-size-fits-all
exactly.
solution. It's great.
Thank you.
So do you see yourself... I mean, you've only been here for 2 years, so you want to continue with solar energy. Do you see yourself broadening out? Do you have other interests in clean energy?
So we are also trying to make chemical feedstocks, which are starting materials to make other products.
Okay, so there's right now you're looking at one application, but there's a lot of different directions you can go.
Exactly. So right now we are focused on splitting water to make hydrogen,
mm-hmm.
Which is storage. But hydrogen is not just used for chemical storage. It's a feedstock to make ammonia. You can make hydrocarbons. So there's a lot of other applications. So if you solve this problem, you're not just solving the energy storage problem, but you can now make hydrogen in a clean way, because otherwise hydrogen is made from methane. And it produces a lot of carbon dioxide as the byproduct.
Interesting, okay.
I like to call my chemistry shake and bake chemistry. So it's as simple as sort of taking powders, mixing them together, and heating them, and hopefully you make the product. And we try to keep things simple, and I think simplicity is a little underappreciated
mm-hmm.
in sciences sometimes,
mm-hmm.
but I think it's important if you think about scaling it up. in future, that you can't use a lot of expensive starting materials or expensive processes or very complicated techniques to make your product.
So, especially if we want it to be widespread.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So we try to be conscious of that. So when we design a synthetic method in our lab, we try to keep it as simple as possible. But at the same time, engineer our product in a way it has all the properties that we want.
Sure.
It has to be a nanoparticle. It has to have high surface area. It has to have the right properties that we're looking at. So doing that can be challenging. Keeping things simple and getting these sort of very complicated properties in your product.
You have to be pretty creative.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we have come up with some, new synthetic methods or new designs, I guess.
Okay.
I want to call it. So a lot of the time when you do these shake and bake chemistry, you use very high temperatures to do it. So we have used an alternative pathways that has cut down a lot of the synthesis temperature by half.
Oh, wow.
Which might not mean a lot, but usually, you know, people use like 1,500 degrees Celsius or 2,000 degrees Celsius to make these materials, some of the materials we're making. So we have cut it down to 1,000 or even 500 sometimes, as low as 500. So
I would imagine that makes a difference just in terms of using less energy to research.
Exactly.
So you're still being more conscious of the environment while doing your own research. Because I think a lot of people are concerned about how they can be clean, how they can make the right choice.
I mean, the answer I still like to give people is that, you know, we talk about three R's,
right?
Reduce, reuse, recycle. I think reduce is really the answer.
Okay.
So
as simple as the three R's, back to grade six.
Yes. I think we just really need to cut down on our materialistic lifestyle and, you know, really reduce consuming products. And maybe we don't need to have the next iPhone.
Sure.
Every time a new model comes out.
And so do you consider yourself someone who follows a lot of sort of ecologically conscious, sort of, are you living a very clean lifestyle?
I try my best, yes, you know, because I think it's important for me to actually live by example. But, you know, I do take public transportation. We do, you know, try to cut down our plastic use, take bags wherever we go, try to reuse materials, you know, not buy a lot of new electronics.
Yeah. So very simple.
Yes.
Very simple.
Yeah.
And so what is your lab like? Are you ever in the field? Is it always sort of the white lab coat, the goggles, and the classic beakers exploding? Or what is it like in your lab?
So a lot of the people who visit my lab usually tell me it looks nothing like a chemistry lab. So it looks more like an engineering lab, to be honest. So we have a lot of furnaces and ovens because we use solid state methods and we do a lot of testing for devices and things. So we have instruments to do that. So for the most part, we do a lot of our research in lab. But once we find a successful material in the lab that we show can do water splitting and things, we do come outside in the quad.
That's
in front of the chemistry building, yes. And we do use natural sunlight to test our catalyst that we have made. So we do some field testing.
your field testing is pretty close to home, though. I think that's fantastic that you're sort of paying it forward with first years. I think a lot of students are concerned about when they're going to get their foot in the door. They don't want to be too late, but when you come in as a first year, you really don't know much. First year chemistry is sort of a massive umbrella to try and teach you the tiniest bit of everything.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I must say, though, I'm very impressed with the first-year students I have in my lab and also some of the other first-year students I've interacted with.
Yeah.
They're very keen. They know more than I did as a first-year student. They're very talented.
Okay, well, thank you so much for sitting down with us today. We had a great time. I hope you enjoyed yourself.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.